Hello, everyone, and welcome to Homicide Hot Dish. I'm your host, Brittany. Now, this episode is actually an old episode. Some of you have heard it, and some of you may have not. This is actually our very first episode that we released, and we ended up pulling it like literally 24 hours later. This is a very local case for us, and my family was not very happy that we were talking about it because of that. They don't really support true crime podcasts and things like that in general anyway, so when they found out I started a podcast and our first episode was a local one, they weren't too happy. So at that time, to save myself from the drama, I just pulled it and left it at that. But I now decided to bring it back because there are like a million news stories on this case, and there's even actually a Snapped episode on it, so I don't see what's so wrong with us talking about it. And since it was just Thanksgiving, I'm sure some of you are still visiting with family and need a little something to listen to while you're traveling. So, just so there's no confusion, again, this is our very first episode, and you will hear Deanna in this one, but again, at the present time, I'm flying solo as we're just trying to figure things out a bit more. Hello, and welcome to our first ever episode of Homicide Hot Dish, where you get your weekly scoop of true crime. I'm Brittany.
And I'm Deanna.
Now, before we get into anything, since we are new, I just wanted to quickly tell you why we decided to start a podcast. So I have found that in most true crime podcasts, the host, I guess, and or co-host, end up spending like literally 15 to 20 minutes just talking before they finally get into a case. And I've found literally only one podcast so far where they just dive into it right away and don't really waste any time. I, for one, hate trying to scan through the podcast just to find when a case discussion starts, and that's when I kind of just give up and start looking for a different podcast. I honestly have no patience, but I do get that some people like to listen to podcasts where, you know, there's kind of a little banter between the hosts or where they talk about something funny, but I want to hear about the murder right away. I want to know who got killed, who was there, when did it happen, where did it happen. That's what I want to hear. I don't care what you did the night before or some funny thing that your kid did. Okay, so I'm not bashing parents. I have two little boys of my own, so I get that you love talking about your kids. I understand. I do the same. But again, I want to get into the crime right away. Now, I do realize I'm sort of doing this right now by talking so much, but that's because since this is our first episode, I just want people to kind of know the structure of our podcast. So I promise in the future episodes, we will get into it right away. Now, how did we come up with our name? Well, we love two things. Number one, homicide, obviously. And the second, being from Minnesota, we love hot dish. I know other states call it casserole, but here we refer to it as hot dish. So we figured, why not put the two together? Not literally, of course, we're not Jeffrey Dahmer. Now, each month we will be discussing cases of a certain theme or topic. For this month, our theme is local murders, and we are from Minnesota, so we're going to be discussing a Minnesota murder each week through the month of September. And for our first story, we are going to be digging into a case of young parenthood, love, lust, and the ultimate betrayal, which actually happened just a few miles from where we grew up in southern Minnesota. Now, real quick, before we do that, we do have to talk hot dish. Yes, I realize I'm still not talking crime, but I promise this will be the only non-crime-related topic we will ever talk about. And it'll be real quick. I'll share this recipe on our Facebook page. Just search for Homicide Hot Dish. This week's recipe is literally the king of all hot dishes.
Tater tot hot dish.
I knew you would get that totally. So I've got a couple secret ingredients that really make it better than your typical tater tot hot dish. Okay, I guess they're not that secretive if I'm giving them away. But anyway, I can't tell you how many times I've honestly made this because, for one, it's super easy to make, which is good for me because I don't have patience with cooking, and it is so good. So again, don't forget to check that out on our Facebook page. And now, on to the homicide. This is the murder of Jim Nibby. Jennifer Gilman was born in 1977 and grew up in Lake Crystal, Minnesota. Now, Lake Crystal's a very small town, maybe 3,000 people or so.
Yeah, pretty small. We call it a bedroom community to Mankato.
Right, exactly. Mankato is a bigger town that's very close by. Growing up, Jennifer had many friends in different age groups, and she just seemed to always fit in and was liked by everyone. She was very popular, she was pretty, blonde, so the guys always seemed to notice her. But she wasn't just a pretty face. She was involved in many sports throughout high school, and she was also very smart academically. Which is why it was kind of a shock when, at just 16 years old, she announced to her family that she was pregnant. She decided she was going to keep the baby, and even though her and the baby's father didn't work out, he was still involved in the baby's life. And she was still very determined to stay in school, even though she now had a pregnancy to deal with on top of keeping up with her schoolwork. She still just really wanted to finish out high school. In February of 1994, she gave birth to a son named Brady. He obviously became her number one priority. She did keep going to school, though, and she lived at home until she graduated high school, and then she started to look at going to college. In 1999, she got a nursing degree, and at 22 years old, she graduated and got a job at a surgery center in Mankato. Like we had said earlier, Mankato is a close town to Lake Crystal. I'd say 15 to 20 minutes from Lake Crystal.
Yep, about that.
Pretty close. We'll say 15 minutes. She worked extra shifts as an EMT to provide for her and Brady. So she really had her life together for being a young single mother. She then bought a small farm just outside Lake Crystal for her and Brady, and everything seemed to be perfect in her life at this point. She was very hardworking, she was successful, she loved being a mother, and she didn't really need a man to provide for her. She was okay being on her own with Brady. That is until she met Jim Nibby. In 2007, when Jennifer was 30 years old, she met Jim Nibby, a 24-year-old electrician's apprentice. Now, Snapped did an episode on this case, and they interviewed the couple's families, and Jim's sister explains how the couple met. She says their younger brother had a girlfriend who went into diabetic shock. Jim was actually the one who found her, and he made the call to 911, and Jennifer was the one to come out on the ambulance. Soon after that, they began going to parties together, hanging out, camping together, and she just quickly fell for him. Jim was a very manly man. He loved being outdoors, he loved hunting, fishing, he was just a big outdoorsman, and Jennifer would actually go out hunting with him at times. Now, Jim's family was very happy for him when he was seeing Jennifer. They thought she was great for him. She was, you know, very successful. She was pretty. She was hardworking. She just seemed to have it all. Both Jennifer and Jim seemed head over heels for each other. However, Jennifer did have someone else in her life, her son, Brady. And she made it very clear to Jim that if he was going to be in her life, Brady was also going to be. That they were basically a package deal. And Jim had absolutely no problem with that. Not even a year after they started dating, Jim asked Brady, who was then 14 years old, if he had permission to marry Jennifer. Brady said yes, and so did Jennifer. In May 2008, Jim and Jennifer were married. At this time, Jim was still interning as an electrician. He was wiring houses, hog barns, doing maintenance, just doing anything he could to keep working. And he was a hard worker, but he was only making around $15,000 a year, which really isn't that much. If you do the math, that's less than $8 an hour that he's making. And Jennifer was paying the bills and providing for Jim, herself, and Brady. She often would pull extra shifts, working 4 a.m. to 11 p.m., so literally working an entire day with little to no sleep. Many times by the time Jennifer got home from working all day, she would just be exhausted and just want to go to bed, which is completely understandable. But when she got home, Jim would be waiting for her. She confided in a cousin of hers that Jim was starting to really become irritating because she'd get home and he'd just want to have sex. He would grope her or try to get on her, and she was just exhausted from the day and just wanted to go to bed. Barely a year after they got married, Jim and Jennifer started to grow apart. Jennifer confided in that cousin again that she was contemplating divorcing Jim. She really needed him to start picking up the slack and contributing more. She was the sole provider, and she was understandably so getting upset with that. And she was planning on telling this to Jim, but before she did that, Jim surprised her. He gave her a 20-gauge shotgun. This is a gun that's typically used for deer hunting or duck hunting, something hunting related, and he did this to remind her of all the good times they shared together when they would go, you know, hunting, fishing, camping, just being outdoors. Jim taught her how to use the gun, he taught her how to load it, unload it, and shoot it. On August 30th, 2010, he took her out back at their home and they did some target practicing with the gun. Now, None of this actually really sounds alarming to me at all because my husband bought me my first shotgun.
Yep, Jeff bought me my first gun.
Right, and a lot of people around here do target practice either to sight in their gun or just to have fun and kind of get some stress relief in. So after the couple is done target practicing, they go to bed. The next morning, August 31st, 2010, just before 6 a.m., Jennifer Nibby makes a call to 911. Now, as I said earlier, the show Snapped did an episode on this case, and I believe it was in 2013. I know it's episode 6 of season 10. Snapped does include her 911 call in that episode. So if you'd like to listen to more of her 911 call, I encourage you to watch that episode. But I will play a short clip of it here for you.
Somebody shot your husband?
Now, it's kind of hard to hear her, but she says, he was inside, he came and shot my husband. Now, Jennifer tells the 911 dispatcher that a masked intruder broke into her house and shot her husband and then attacked and cut her. And that then he left, but she doesn't know where he went because she was actually on the living room floor. She definitely sounds like a frantic wife on the call. I mean, she's crying, she's kind of hysterical and distressed. A sheriff arrives to the Nibby home shortly after that 911 call was made, and when he got to the home, he saw Jennifer and her son Brady. Yes, Brady was home at the time.
What? I have so many questions.
I know, so I'll get to that in a little bit. She tells the sheriff that she was in the shower in their bathroom, which is attached to their bedroom, when the shooting occurred. And she says once she heard the shot, she came out of the bathroom and the intruder grabbed her, drug her to the living room, put a rope around her neck, and she said he was carrying a knife. She didn't really describe much detail about the intruder because she says he was dressed in all black and he had nylon over his head. And she tells the sheriff that before the man left, he said, "You're lucky you're not dead." A knife and a piece of rope were found on the living room floor along with a Sith, which was lying on a chair. Now, Deanna, do you know what a Sith is?
No clue.
Okay, so I had to look this up because even though I'm also from a rural farming community, I didn't know what this is. So a Sith is an agricultural tool that's used to cut crops like wheat or grass. It's got a long pole that you hold on to that has this like long curved blade attached to the end of it. So, okay, picture the Grim Reaper, you know, that big knife or sword looking thing he carries.
Oh, yeah.
That's a Sith.
Oh, okay.
So I don't believe anyone uses this tool anymore as we have machinery now, but back in the older days, this is what they would use. So anyway, it's not typically something you would keep in the house. You'd keep it in a shed or an outbuilding. Officers found Jim lying face down in a bed with his arms up over his head. You know, like when you're sleeping on your stomach and you have your arms up kind of above your pillow?
Yeah.
That's how Jim was found. And the blankets were pulled up to his shoulder blade area, which also made it look like he had been sleeping when he was shot. And paramedics confirmed that Jim was dead from a single gunshot wound to the back of the head. Now, guess whose gun was used to kill him?
Was it Jenny's?
Yep. It was Jennifer's 20-gauge shotgun that Jim had given her.
Of course.
Right, of course. There'd be no other gun that would have been used. Now, remember I said Brady was home at the time of the shooting?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, according to the Mankato Free Press, when Brady talks to the investigators, he tells them that he was sleeping.
Sleeping?
Mm-hmm, sleeping. And he says Jennifer woke him up saying that Jim's been shot and she'd been cut by an intruder. So Brady says he slept through this whole ordeal. The shooting, the struggle between Jennifer and the intruder, everything. So he gives little information about the shooting. Now, okay, I don't know about you, but in my opinion, no matter how heavy of a sleeper I am, I'd probably wake up to a shotgun blast, especially being in the same house as it.
Well, right, I wake up to my dog scratching his collar in the middle of the night.
Okay, right, and I mean, you can hear a shotgun blast from a mile away.
Easily.
Maybe even 2 miles. Well, okay, I don't know. 2 miles might be stretching it, but my point is you can hear them from a long ways away. So unless you literally sleep like a rock or you've got headphones in or something, that just seems pretty odd to me. But we're just going to give him the benefit of the doubt and say he's a very heavy sleeper and he didn't hear it. So, after Jennifer wakes him up and tells him that Jim's been killed and she'd been cut, he says he wasn't sure if the intruder was still in the house, which does make sense because, I mean, this should just happen. Who knows where the guy is? So, Brady says he grabbed a separate shotgun and loaded 4 shells into it. He says he then went upstairs with the gun and waited for the cops to come, and he says that's when he noticed there was a rope, a knife, and a Sith in the living room. Now, in the meantime, between Jennifer and Brady giving their statements, the sheriff's deputies are checking out the property. They're, you know, trying to find the killer's trail, or maybe he's still on the property, maybe he's hiding. You know, he could have been looking for items to steal outside, heard the cops coming, so he's hiding in a shed or something. But they check everywhere, and there is absolutely no sign of the intruder. Now, according to the Mankato Free Press, after Jennifer gives her statement to the sheriff, a deputy arrives, and when she talks with him, her story changes a bit. She tells the deputy that, yes, she was in the bathroom, as she had told the sheriff, but she said she had been brushing her teeth at the time of the shooting. Now, remember, she told the sheriff that she was in the shower during the shooting. Now, to me, the first thing you would look for when someone says that they were in the shower is if their hair is wet. So I don't know if maybe she realized her hair wasn't wet and figured she needed to change her story quickly. I couldn't find if her hair was wet or not. And I do know people take showers, you know, and they don't just wash their hair. I mean, I've done that. So, but I feel like most of the time they do. But either way, her story changes. She says once she heard the loud bang, she opened the bathroom door and saw a man standing over her husband and holding a shotgun. She said he then points the gun at her and pulls the trigger, but nothing happens, which indicates that maybe the gun jammed, or maybe he only put one shell in, which he used on Jim, or maybe he even put the safety back on, because, I mean, that's possible, right?
Safety first.
Exactly. Safety first. Whatever the case may be, the gun just doesn't go off. So she says he then throws the gun down and grabs her, pulls her to the living room, and then puts a rope around her neck, and that he holds both sides of the rope. She said that while they were in the living room, he was on top of her, pulling at her clothes and cutting her legs.
So she is wearing clothes, which is weird to me if she said that she was in the shower and is just popping out to check on a noise fully dressed.
Okay, very good point. So, okay, she heard some noise, stepped out of the shower, quickly got dressed. Obviously, she didn't put on a robe because she says the intruder was pulling at her clothes. Well, he wouldn't pull at a robe. And then she checked on Jim. So, Jim's your husband. I'm willing to bet he's seen you naked. So, why did you think you needed to quickly put on clothes to go talk to your husband and ask him what that noise was? So, okay, whatever. Let's say she did put clothes on for whatever reason. And so, if that is true, I mean, since this guy is pulling at her clothes, maybe it was a rape that didn't go as planned. You know, maybe the intruder looked at Jim as being in the way of this guy having his way with Jennifer, so he kills Jim. She says she then tried to scratch his face, but he was wearing a nylon. And she says the man left, and she doesn't know why, but she does say that their dog was outside barking and just kind of going crazy. So, I don't know, maybe he ran because he was afraid of the dog. She says then the man says to her before he leaves, "You're lucky, bitch." Not, "You're lucky you're not dead," as she had told the sheriff previously. Which, at first, is kind of raised a red flag for me, but now I kind of get it because, I mean, there's a lot going on, her adrenaline is pumping, so I could see that she might not remember exactly what he had said to her. Jennifer also tells investigators that basically her marriage was fine, that her and Jim didn't have any problems within their marriage, and that neither one of them was having an affair or anything. So, obviously, there's nothing wrong in their marriage. No abuse, no secret lovers, nothing like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, keep that in mind, because we will get to that in a little bit. Jennifer tells the officers that she blames herself for Jim's death. She says that she left the kitchen door unlocked when she let the dog out that morning, which would make sense that no forced entry was found. And she was sort of hysterical at that point. I mean, as you can imagine, your husband was just killed and you barely made it out alive. She then tells them about her and Jim target shooting out behind the house with her new gun the day before. She says she didn't put the gun away when they were done, that she just leaned it up against the wall beside the kitchen door. Jennifer was then put in an ambulance and taken to the hospital to be examined. And even before she got to the hospital, investigators started doubting her story. The story just didn't make much sense, and I mean, she did change her story from when she talked to the sheriff, who was first on the scene, to when she talked to the deputy later. And for another thing, they found absolutely no trace of an intruder anywhere. And it was muddy outside because it had been raining the day of the shooting, but there were no tracks found anywhere outside. No shoe prints, no tire marks, nothing. Even inside the house, they didn't find any mud or tracks of any kind. So Unless this guy came in on a helicopter and literally propelled down to the front steps, there's no way this happened. And even though Jennifer says she struggled with the intruder in the living room on the floor, there were little signs of a struggle or anything to back up her statement. There was a chair that was pushed up on top of a small magazine rack. You know, like those small magazine racks that your grandma has that sits on the floor?
Grandma, I've got three of them.
Oh, shit. You do? Okay, I guess. So those little racks that your grandma or, how old are you, 30?
Yes.
Or 30-year-olds have. So, you know what I'm talking about then. Well, the chair was kind of propped up on that, and it just didn't look real. It looked staged. Investigators then looked at Jennifer's legs. Remember, she had cuts on her legs from the intruder?
Right.
Well, the cuts lined up with each other almost perfectly identical on each leg, making it seem like her wounds were actually self-inflicted rather than defense wounds. All of this just didn't make sense and didn't line up, and investigators came to the conclusion that there was no intruder. Jim's murder was done by someone inside the house, which means either Jennifer or her 16-year-old son, Brady. Now, my mind kind of went to Jim's family at this point. I mean, you know, Jim's dead, so how long is it before they find out? It seems that his family's pretty close, so I wouldn't expect it to be too long before they would find out, especially with Lake Crystal being such a small, tight-knit community. Well, I found a Facebook page that Jim's family started after his murder. It's called In Memory of James M. Nibby. Now, this is a public page, so anybody can see this, and I believe his sister runs it. Anyway, his sister writes of how their family learned of Jim's murder. She writes that on the morning of August 31st, their dad called her and said that one of Jim's neighbors had called and said that there are police cars and yellow police tape all over at the end of Jim's driveway. He asks if she'll just go over and see what's going on. So on her way over, she calls Jim, but there's no answer. So she leaves a message asking him to call her back ASAP so that she knows he's okay. And she says, "I love you," and hangs up. She then tries calling their house and Jennifer, but of course, there's no answer. She kind of starts to get a horrible feeling at this point that something really bad has happened. She kept telling herself, though, that Jim's fine, that whatever happened, it's either Jennifer or Brady, but not Jim. When she pulls up to the Navy home, the sheriff comes up to her and asks who she is. When she tells him that she's Jim's sister, he just says that there's been a shooting. He won't tell her anything else. And of course, all she wants to know is if Jim is okay. So, obviously frustrated, she tells him that somebody needs to give her answers. So he calls for a detective to come out to the home. When the detective pulls up, he gets out of his car and tells her that her brother was killed. Now, my brother is 26 years old, the same age of Jim when he was murdered, so I can't even imagine what his sister was going through at that moment. She doesn't write anything else about it, but I can only imagine how confused and angry and sad she felt at that point. I honestly would have lost my mind. Now, there wasn't really anything pointing to Brady. Yeah, it sounds kind of fishy that he says he was sleeping through the whole thing, but ultimately everything was leading towards Jennifer. Investigators asked Jim's family if there would be any reason at all for Jennifer to want Jim dead. Jim's family tells the investigators that the pair had grown apart and Jennifer was gone a lot more. She was spending time with friends, more than usual, but nothing that would make them think that she would actually want Jim killed. Investigators then speak with Jennifer's family, and according to that Snapped episode, they get a little different story and actually kind of a surprise. Jennifer's dad tells investigators that the couple was really struggling financially. Jennifer had $20,000 in credit card debt. She had a second mortgage on the house. They were behind on house payments. The list goes on and on. Jennifer's cousin revealed that she started talking to an old flame. Her cousin says Jennifer and the man kept it to a texting, or I guess sexting more so, rather than an actual physical relationship or physical affair.
Oh my God, kids these days.
Right? Damn kids. Her cousin says Jennifer seemed to want the relationship to develop further. She had sent him very explicit photos of herself. However, Jennifer's cousin says she didn't think it had gone to a physical relationship just yet. Her cousin says that they talked about this man and Jennifer asked if she thought that they should meet. Her cousin tells her no. Which, you know, I mean, it's not a good idea. She's married. Maybe just wait until her and Jim possibly separate or get a divorce, I guess, if that would happen. Now, remember, Jennifer told investigators at the crime scene that there was nothing wrong in their marriage. No affairs, everything was just fine. So, obviously, she wasn't telling the truth. Once the investigators hear of Jennifer's sexting affair, they grew more suspicious of her, which makes sense. I mean, here's a woman whose husband gets killed while she's having an affair, and her stories just don't line up, which makes her look very suspicious. Investigators then pull her phone records and confirm that she was having a sexting affair with another man. Jennifer also kept a diary, which revealed that she was indeed very unhappy in her marriage to Jim, and that she was in love with this other guy. Deanna, I've got two quotes here from her diary entries that I would like you to read.
In her diary, she writes, quote, "I thought he would be able to help more, but he's fishing this weekend. Doesn't have money to contribute more to the household financials," end quote. Another entry she wrote says, quote, "I'm married to one man that I care about, but in love with another man who has a girlfriend and a baby on the way, but still tells me he loves me. I could scream. Sometimes I wish I could go back to just Brady and I," end quote.
So obviously she's talking about Jim in the first quote, you know, saying he's busy fishing, doesn't have money to help out with things around the house. And I kind of find it interesting with her side dude or whatever you want to call him. Not only does he have a girlfriend, but she's also pregnant. So not only is Jennifer, potentially, I guess, destroying his relationship, but this guy also is going to be a father. Fox 9 Minneapolis St. Paul reported on this case multiple times, and they included pictures from her diary as well as text messages. So I will read some of the quotes from her diary and text messages they shared. They do replace the man's name with him and also reword some of that explicit wording. On August 21st, 2010, just 10 days before Jim's murder, she writes, quote, "I can't let him go. I want him so bad and he wants me," end quote. She continues to write, "I just sent him a naughty picture of me and he wants to have sex with me tomorrow. Can I control myself and say no? I don't think I can. I want him. I've always had feelings for him. I can't stop thinking about him and I together." Then on August 26th, he sends her a text that says, quote, "I wish I could see you in your bikini. How fun would it be to have sex on your picnic table?" End quote. Then on August 30th, around 5 p.m., they make plans to meet up later in the week. And just 12 hours later, Jim is dead. As investigators dug even further, they found letters from collections agencies at the house, which also confirmed the couple's financial issues. When searching receipts and financial records from the Nibby home, investigators found many receipts for the drug tramadol, which is a drug that's used to treat disorders like rheumatoid arthritis and fibromyalgia. This kind of made it look like maybe Jennifer had become addicted to prescription painkillers and that, as a registered nurse, she had maybe forged prescriptions from her place of work for her personal addiction. In fact, many of the checks that investigators found that Jennifer had written were for tramadol. And this is where a lot of the couple's money was going. This was kind of supported by Jim's family members. They began to suspect that something was wrong with Jennifer because of the way she started acting. They said it just wasn't right. In an interview for that Snapped episode, they said that they thought she was on drugs, or one family member even thought that maybe she had cancer or something. They said she was just very off and not her usual self. As investigators dug even deeper into the Nibby's financial records, they discovered that there was a $250,000 life insurance policy on Jim. Odd, since Jennifer was the couple's main income source, and even more odd is the fact that this policy was taken out just 3 months before Jim's murder.
3 months?
Yeah, 3 months. Definitely not making things look good for Jennifer right now. I mean, not only was she having an affair, but here's even more motive to want Jim dead. And she was obviously the beneficiary of his life insurance policy. Then, on September 10th, 2010, just 10 days after Jim's murder, and only 2 days after his funeral, Jennifer got the shock of her life. She was arrested outside the surgery center where she worked. There are reports that she seemed shocked and surprised when she was arrested, which makes me think she really thought she got away with murder, if she's really guilty. But besides that, why are you back at work already? I mean, your husband's funeral was literally 2 days ago. He was just killed 10 days ago. I would think that if my husband just died, I would need to take a lot more time off of work. I don't know how soon she went back to work. Maybe she only took a day or two and went back right away. I haven't found that out. But either way, she was at least back to work 10 days after he was killed. But, you know, she was struggling financially. She couldn't pay the bills or her mortgage. So maybe she just thought she had no other option. She didn't have time to take off work and grieve the loss of Jim because she had bills to pay. Jim's family found out about Jennifer's arrest, and as you can imagine, they were in shock. They felt so much betrayal and hurt from someone they loved. How could someone who says they love your son kill him? In his sleep. That night, September 10th, after Jennifer's arrest, she was booked into the Blue Earth County Jail in Mankato on second-degree murder. Now, in Minnesota, for her to be brought in on a first-degree murder charge, she would have to be indicted from a grand jury. So, eventually that could happen, but for now, they could just get her on a second-degree murder charge. The next day, investigators question Jennifer, and this is when she comes clean. So, before she goes into detail about Jim's murder, she tells the detectives that she has an addiction to prescription pain pills. And when she says this, she begins to kind of sob, and she said her addiction started over 2 years ago. One of the detectives asks her how much she uses, and the amount is excessive, to say the least. Deanna, how many pills do you think she takes in a week?
In a week? I don't know, maybe 10 to 12?
Nope. She says she takes 180 pills a week.
180? That's like 25 a day.
Yeah, that is like 10 times the dose you should be taking. That's literally a lethal dose.
Wow.
Now, after she confesses about her addiction to pain pills, she starts to talk about how Jim really died. And I found a video that the Free Press actually shared that is a longer version of her confession than what they play in that Snapped episode. I'd say it's maybe 5 minutes long or so. The audio isn't that great, and it's kind of hard to hear her at times, but I will play a little piece of it here for you, and I'm also going to share the link on our Facebook page so you can watch the whole video if you'd like.
And I'd fallen back to sleep, though. And I woke up at 5:30 in a panic. And that's when I went out and I cut the code. And I loaded one shell. And I came back into the bedroom. And there was a throw blanket laying on the end of the bed. So I took that and kind of rest the gun on his shoulder. And he just kept saying, and I pulled the trigger.
So, like I said, some of it was kind of hard to hear, not only because of the sound, but because she does kind of go into a whisper at times. So, she says that she had a couple more pills lying on the nightstand that she took, and this was at about 4:30 in the morning on August 31st, the day of Jim's murder. She then says she fell back asleep after taking the pills, and that she woke up again around 5:30 in the morning in a panic. This is when she says she went into the kitchen and saw the shotgun. She grabbed it and loaded one shell. Then she went back into the bedroom where Jim was still asleep. And then she says something that I don't know many people saw coming. I, for one, didn't. She talks about hearing voices in her head, and she says, quote, "It was like someone was telling me he's the devil," end quote. She says that these voices urged her to kill him. Then she mentions grabbing a blanket that was at the end of the bed. Her confession video that I watched didn't go into any more detail on that, so I don't know if she used the blanket to kind of muffle the sound of the gun going off, which I guess would make more sense than why Brady didn't wake up, but still, I would think he would have heard a loud boom from the gun going off, but whatever, we're gonna move on from that. So Jennifer says she then rested the gun on Jim's shoulder and pulled the trigger. And she says, the whole time, she keeps hearing these voices in her head, and she says, quote, "They just kept saying, he's the devil, he's the devil," end quote. As she's saying this, if you watch the video, she kind of goes into a whisper when she says that, and then she kind of leans back in the chair and covers her face and starts kind of crying. So she's definitely showing remorse, but I don't know if it's the remorse for what she did and that she realizes it was wrong, or if it's more of a selfish remorse for herself where she's like, you know, oh crap, I'm caught, now there's no turning back, my life is over.
Right. Is she sad about her own future, or is she sad for what she actually did?
Right. And then she also says, quote, "It was horrible. It was horrible. Once it happened, I thought, oh my God, what did I do? What did I do?" End quote. So this also makes me think that she's kind of thinking of herself and what her future now looks like. She says she checked for a pulse on Jim after she shot him and couldn't find one. She then tells them that she staged the overturned chair in the living room and that she cut her legs with a kitchen knife to make it appear that the intruder had attacked her. So there is one thing she says in the interview that actually kind of makes me think she maybe does feel remorse for what she did. And as she is crying, she says, Deanne, I want you to say what she says here. So she's crying when she says this.
I took somebody's son and I killed somebody's brother and grandson and uncle, and he was a good person. He was a good person.
Now, that just sounds to me like she is remorseful and acknowledging that it wasn't just her husband that she killed. He was a son. He was a brother. He was an uncle. So maybe she really truly does feel sorry for taking his life. And investigators say to her, you know you made a horrible mistake. And she says, mm-hmm. So she does acknowledge what she did. After her interview, investigators pretty much knew they had enough evidence against Jennifer to get that grand jury indictment for first-degree murder. Now, the difference between first-degree and second-degree murder is premeditation. And by Jennifer getting out of bed, going to the kitchen, grabbing the shotgun, loading the shotgun, and then going back to the bedroom shows premeditation. And being convicted of premeditated murder in the first degree holds a consequence of life without parole. Jennifer's defense attorney quickly requested a mental examination to see if she was competent to stand trial before it even got to the grand jury. Her defense team claimed that she, conveniently, had no memory of her confession now. Her attorney said the reason for her memory loss was because of all the prescription drugs she was taking, and that by taking that lethal dose of pills, it had an effect on her memory. According to the Mankato Free Press, the assistant Blue Earth County attorney asked Jennifer, what do you recall? And Jennifer says, quote, I remember getting up that morning. A lot of it is blank. I do remember the police being there. I remember being at the hospital, end quote. So she really makes it seem as though she completely blacked out during the shooting. However, she was ultimately found competent to stand trial. And on March 30th, 2011, the grand jury indicted her with first-degree premeditated murder. After this, the defense team was kind of in a frenzy a little bit. They got their own psychological evaluation for Jennifer as well, now knowing that she faces the possibility of life without parole. So basically, they were trying to pull out all the stops they had. One of the therapists said that Jennifer even showed signs of PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress disorder. During her sessions with the defense's therapist, Jennifer's memory began to return. She started to talk about physical and sexual abuse from Jim, saying that he would choke her until she would black out and then he would rape her, and that she would wake up in blood. This, she said, happened at least weekly, and she claims that it also happened the night that Jim was killed. She says he raped her twice that night. The defense blames abuse and PTSD as reasoning for Jennifer killing Jim. Now, I don't know if her son was home or not during this time. I'm talking the night that Jim was killed, or, well, I guess any other time it actually happened. Her son is 16 years old, and I would think that if his mom is in a struggle with Jim, that he would come to her aid. You know, she claims being physically abused by Jim, being raped by Jim, so I would think that her son would have heard this happen. I mean, you know, she says it happened at least weekly, so obviously sometimes more. So to me, that would mean that sometimes this would occur while her son is in the house too. So it just doesn't seem right to me that Brady wouldn't do anything to try to help her. He'd just let Jim beat her, and I don't know, that just doesn't seem right to me.
Well, when we were 16, how often were we home?
You're right. We were rarely ever home at that age. So I guess that would make sense then. So maybe Brady wasn't around then.
But my question is, did she write about it in her diary?
No, she doesn't write it in her diary or even tell anyone.
Interesting.
Very interesting. So now that the defense has this information, you know, Jennifer claiming that Jim's physically abusive and that he raped her, they just needed proof.
Right, right.
And guess what?
They don't find any.
They don't find any. Jennifer never once mentioned any physical abuse to anyone. She never filed a police report either. And during her confession, not once does she mention physical abuse. Instead, at the end of her confession, she says, twice, he was a good person, he was a good person. So that to me doesn't sound like someone who is in a physically abusive relationship. The defense was then preparing to go to trial and found some rather interesting information regarding Jim's autopsy that could actually potentially help Jennifer's case. They found that there was a test done and that Jim tested positive for HIV, meaning that maybe he wasn't the loving, devoted husband people thought he was. Maybe he was sneaking around. However, according to the prosecutors, the HIV result was not actually reliable because the medical examiner had told them that this is basically just a mandatory screening that they always do and you can't really go by it. They said they get a lot of false positives in the postmortem phase, so basically it's just got to be ruled out. And it was not, in fact, proven that Jim was HIV positive. And actually, just months before Jim's death, remember that $250,000 life insurance policy taken out on Jim?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in June, just a few months prior to his death, he had to get tested for HIV for that life insurance policy. And guess what?
It was negative.
Yep, he tested negative. Jennifer was in jail for almost 2 years awaiting trial for murder, and other than her word, there's literally nothing to back up her claims of physical abuse. And, I mean, Jim's family told investigators that before the murder, she was going out with friends more, and she was gone a lot more as the couple had started to grow apart. So, if she's spending more and more time with friends, I would think that they would notice something.
Well, if she was able to hide it from her friends, she could have done that, but you would think that she'd at least still write it in her diary or told her cousin that she was close with.
Right. At the very least, I would have thought, you know, she'd write it in her diary or tell that cousin who she seems to confide in all the time, especially because she pretty much writes everything else in that diary or tells everything else to her cousin. So why wouldn't she write about that or tell that to her cousin? In June 2012, Jennifer's attorneys approached the prosecution looking for a deal. The prosecutor made an offer that they would forgo the life without parole if Jennifer agreed to plead guilty to second-degree murder, and Jennifer took the deal. July 9th, 2012 was Jennifer's sentencing hearing, and when Jennifer talked to the court, guess what? She still claimed she couldn't recall anything about the events, that she had no clear memory of anything but the abuse.
Ugh, she stressed me out.
Oh my god, I know, right? But even so, the judge sentenced her to 25 years in prison with the possibility of supervised release in 15 years.
Ugh.
I know. Tell me about it. I know. So she's going to be eligible for supervised release in 2027, which is just 7 years from now, and she'll be 50 years old. So she's going to have plenty of life left to live outside of jail with Brady and her family. Now, even though this was a horrible, tragic event that took place, the Nibby family did a couple amazing things. They got a bill passed called the Homicide Victim Specified Personal Property Protection Inventory and Emergency Order, better known as Jim's Law. This was a revision made to what was known as the Slayer Statute. So now, what this means is if somebody intentionally kills someone else, they are prevented from benefiting from a will or an insurance policy or a contract agreement, anything as a result of the victim. So Jennifer will not see a single penny of Jim's $250,000 life insurance policy.
I can't believe this wasn't already a law.
I know. So, well, it sort of was, but they just added to it to make sure that there is absolutely no way that somebody could benefit at all from a victim's death. But yeah, why wasn't this done a long time ago? Who knows? Jim's family also started a scholarship in Jim's name. It's called the James Nibby Outstanding Character Award. This scholarship is awarded annually to a student at Jim's high school, which is Lake Crystal Welcome Memorial High School. So, even though this was a horrible thing to have happened, Jim's family was able to turn this into something positive in Jim's name. And with that, we want to thank you for listening to our first episode of Homicide Hot Dish. And be sure to tune in next week for our second local murders episode.